What I wanted to start with today is that the task is impossible. To sit down and in just a very brief, a very tiny little period of time and talk about the history, culture, faith, and what was the other, spirituality of Native Americans is not possible. So that's okay, that we, as long as we all know that, then we'll be okay. What I wanted to do today, in honor of Scott's work with us all this week, is I want to begin with a prayer to the Six Directions, which is my 20th century, my 1985 expression of a traditional experience of praying to the Six Directions. I'm not a traditional Indian, and I have decided that I can't be a traditional Indian in terms of teaching the traditional ways of the Lakota people. But I think there is something of great value and gift to the Lutherans and to the world to take time out to think about the Six Directions. And so today, my prayer to the Six Directions is going to be addressed to the six elements within ourselves, at least six, okay? So I invite you to join me. We'll stand and face the east. As we look to the rising sun, and we send a voice in this direction, a voice that is connected to all life in this direction. We send a voice that celebrates the exciting things within us, that names the laughing child that we have been and still are somewhere inside. We send a voice that celebrates the strong and handsome and interesting young men and young women that we are and have been and continue to be. We send a voice that celebrates the mature masculinity that is within all of us, as well as the fruitful and important femininity that is in us all. We send a voice that celebrates the wisdom and maturity that we have, that we develop, and that we carry and pass to the generations that are to come. We send a voice to the east and the rising sun, and we look up and see the reality of the good that we are, the reality of the special persons that we are, the rareness, the uniqueness, the individuality that our Creator has taken the time and the trouble to pass into us. We accept the fact that we are the perfect form of the model for who we are. There is no other one that has ever been created or ever will be created that expresses what we are. Let's turn to the south. As we face the south, we send out a voice that accepts and acknowledges the troubled, angry, selfish, and unhappy child within us. We send a voice that sees and names and understands the wrong things that we did when we were children, the things we thought and the things that we said and the things that we did. And we send a voice that names and acknowledges the wrong things that we did when we were growing, when we were teenagers. The anger, the heartache, and the pain. As we send a voice to the south, knowing that we are connected to all of humanity, and that we all say these things, we name the pain that we experienced when we were children, and growing teenagers, the wrong things, the evil that touched our lives. As we send a voice to the South, we name the sadness and sorrow, the separation and anger, the shadow, the darkness that is within us as we move into adulthood. And we also accept the realities of our own inconsistencies, our own failure to understand, our own inability to love. We name the realities of sadness and pain in our lives, our terror as we live, our fear about dying, our concern for ourselves, our disinterest in others. We know that we have logs in our eyes, and we know too that we spend an awful lot of time trying to dig specks out of others. And so we send a voice naming the dark side, but we also are willing to say this, that in this direction, in the South, there is a treasure. In the night, there is a resting. In crying, there is a setting free. In owning our sinfulness, we have a tremendous gift of grace, which we have the opportunity to experience as we are willing to name our emptiness. If we are nothingness, God is fullness and able to fill us. And so we send a voice that is soft and compassionate and gentle in this direction of ourselves. And we turn to the West. And as we send a voice to this direction, we admit that we were created children, that we played, that we laughed, that we made things up, that we had dreams. We imagined ourselves wonderful things. We invented new things as teenagers. We own the things that we have made, the abilities that we have within, our gifts, our creativity, the art that we know how to create, the words that we put together, the stories that we know how to tell. We celebrate our ingenuity as adults as we face problems and come up with creative solutions, that we take nothing and we make something out of it. We celebrate our abilities to be creative and to experience the creativity of others. We send a voice that celebrates the potential that we have, the things we haven't yet created, the words we haven't yet put together, the songs we still have to write and sing. We celebrate the energy of creativity that comes and passes between us as we participate in the lives of infants and children and adults, the creative teaching that we do that takes a mask of sorrow off of another person's face, that reveals to someone in our lives that they are in fact beautiful. We celebrate all the creative energies that are here within us. And as we turn to the North, we accept the reality of the kinds of transformations that are happening in us. We know that we were once infants and helpless and utterly dependent, and we were transformed into children, active and running, busy and growing. And we know that the children were transformed in an awesome experience into men and women. And those transformations came as a gift from God. We know that we have been transformed from people who couldn't speak to those who had language. We were transformed from self-interest to caring. We were transformed from angry and unhappy to peaceful. and will in fact experience those transformations over and over again in our lives. We look to this direction and we send out a voice naming the transformations that are going on within us as we change from being parents and mothers of small children, fathers of growing children, and we admit that we are being transformed to mature adults whose vision is being challenged to spread to the generations that are ahead, to the people who are beyond us. We're being transformed from hatred to love, from death to resurrection, from suffering to grace and healing, from sickness to health, from separateness to wholeness. We name these transformations as a part of ourselves, and we send a voice of willingness to be transformed, reshaped, reformed into new images, to be made whole and perfect. As we face the east and we look down and we look within ourselves, we send a voice that expresses a willingness to see the whole of ourselves, the many little personalities that exist within us. We send a voice that is willing to vision ourselves not as they necessarily were, but as they might be. A willingness to be gentle and compassionate with ourselves. And yet, a willingness to be as the mother eagle, pushing the eaglet to the edge of the nest and off. A willingness to jump off and spread our wings and fly. Knowing that in our terror, we can find courage. In our anger, we can find hope. Knowing that if we come into a place of danger and pain, there is always a mother eagle swooping underneath to catch us and lift us up and restore us. So as we look up to the sixth direction, we stand silently, celebrating the unique sacredness of our own lives. Okay. The image that I invite you to hold on to for the next 55 minutes is that image of safety, of being safely on the back of a mother eagle, and an image of vision, because the mother eagle flies so high. And so we're going to take one of those high looks at a broad world, and that broad world is the world of the original native indigenous peoples of North America. And occasionally we'll be able to have the vision of an eagle, sort of zeroing in on one particular thing, realizing that in fact you cannot see everything with that zeroing microscopic focus. When you look at one particular thing, you don't see everything else in focus. It kind of gets blurry. If you focus on that peace crane there or one of those, the rest of the room is here, there somewhere, but not totally in focus. And so as we sort of zoom down on one thing, we accept the reality that means that we're choosing not to see some other things in clear focus. Another image that I would like you to consider as we do this today is the image of a spiral dance, that somewhere along the line in your experience of American Indians, in the journey of your life, as you've come around different Indian experiences. Maybe it is limited, and maybe it's extensive. As you move around, remembering that you dance from your own perspective. You see from where you are. You experience what you see through your own whole self and system. And as you dance by, you hear through your ears. And sometimes in that journey, as you move by the sounds that are across the way from you, are hard to hear and hard to bring into focus. And sometimes if you have danced in a circle and you really are in motion, you realize that you get to focusing on your own journey, your own steps. You don't want to stumble or fall. And you don't always see real clearly everything that's around you. And when I dance, I get into my own step, and I don't always see what's happening to the rest of the dancers. And I invite you to kind of play with that image as we talk. I think our spiral dance is to a lot of different kinds of music. And as I prepared to come up here and teach, I meditated on the kind of music that comes out of Indian peoples and about Indians and who is playing the drum, and how can we join the spiral dance of Indian people? How can we share that experience? Who are the singers of the drum? And it seemed to me that a lot of people do experience Indians through the voice of a non-Indian, through the eyes of an anthropologist, or an archaeologist, or a teacher, or maybe even a media person, you know, the writer of a series on television. There's lots of voices out there. I remember one time I went through Wall Rug. Have you ever been to Wall Rug? If you've ever been to Wall, you never forget it. Someone always said to me, if you go on the reservation, you remember you gotta go to Wall. And it was a real experience for me to experience Wall Drug. And especially because I experienced Wall Drug on the same day that I experienced the museum in Rapid City, South Dakota, about the Sioux people. And the contrast between the information that was out there about Indians in Wall Drug and in the museum, because, I mean, they had to... beadwork that, well, it was just, if you walk through Wall Drug, you could almost get the whole range of experience of Indians from real stereotype and real kind of offensive images clear to authentic self images that were there if you look for them, but sometimes they were hard to see. I remember the painting that you could stand behind and stick your own head through, and it was a kind of an Indian woman in buckskin and a man and a teepee, and you could stick your head through and they could take a picture of you. It was an Indian picture. Real adventure. But what are the voices that are out there that tell you about Indians? And just sort of to be aware. So I selected these two books to do that. And I'm only holding up one. This first 8 sessions, I've tried and had tremendous difficulty sharing with you the story of Indians as it's told through a non-Indian's perspective, Henry Warner Bowden. I really appreciate his perspective because I think it's a very scholarly work that is well done, very well done. He has got some of the best primary source material that I've seen, so that it's really a good quality book, and I wanted to do it because it's recommended to you by the National Indian Lutheran Board on their handout of where to begin. Anybody who is in a church context who may be in a position to work with Indian people, it's recommended. This is one of those must-read books. So it's American Indians and Christian Missions by Henry Warner Bowden. It's been very difficult for me to be an Indian telling the story about Indians from a non-Indian's point of view. but it's been very learning. Next week, or actually tomorrow, I'm going to start with an Indian book written by Alvin Josephy called Now That the Buffalo Is Gone. And it has three parts and tells about the past, the story of yesterday, the story of today, and the story of tomorrow. And it's very differently organized and a very different experience. Where I'm at today, then, is on modern Indian religions, the work of churches in the 20th century, and the kinds of spirituality that's out there in the 20th century. And so I'd like to kind of just kind of quickly go through here, reminding you that we are on an eagle's back and that we cannot see the whole. We're just kind of looking at the shape of the land and inviting you at some point in your lives to sort of dive down. Another thing about looking at things from so far above is that you don't get a true feeling for it. And yesterday I was talking about Shaker religion and smokehouse religion. Having experienced it, telling you about it is one thing, but if you ever get an opportunity, and if you're in the Pacific Northwest, you will get an opportunity if you come to One in the Spirit. It's so different to do than it is to tell, to experience than it is to hear a story, to live it than it is to hear about it. So anyway. You can experience the religion of Indian people. There is in modern Indian spirituality kind of a tension going on. A tension between a traditional spiritual way that is an inheritor of the traditional stories and rituals and concepts of the early indigenous peoples. And those that energy, that heritage, that history is still very active in a lot of Indian groups, and it's very vital, and that's one element. There is also, though, the remnants and survivals and modern expressions of the results of missionary work, so that you have a lot of Indian Christians. Lutherans have Indian missions. In the Pacific Northwest, we have the Rocky Boy Mission in Box Elder, Montana. And that is an Indian expression of Lutheranism, which is a good place to observe the tension between traditional language, traditional culture, traditional religion, and sort of an outside form, a Lutheran form. And so that's a good place to feel that sort of maybe even conflict that continues to exist. In Rock Point, in the Navajo country, there's a Lutheran Navajo mission, and they speak their own language, like Wes was telling me, because he had lived down there, when they got the red book came through. They threw the red book out and they proceeded to sing the songs in their own language. There are many Christian traditions of on the Warm Springs Reservation. There's a Presbyterian church, which is it has a Presbyterian pastor, but it is the experience of worshiping in an Indian Presbyterian church is very different from the experience of worshiping in a non-Indian Presbyterian church, even though it's still Presbyterian. Same thing is true of Lutheran. Okay, what I have been doing is telling about some of the major church experiences, mission work that was done in and amongst Indians up to the 20th century. And now I wanted to talk a little bit about what has happened since then. Okay, you need to understand, I think, that missionary work has been so connected to economic and political struggles that sometimes you can't really separate them. But anyway, in 1908, there was a form, all the different Protestant missionaries, or many of them, joined what they called the Home Missions Council. And that was a subsidiary of the Federal Council of Churches. In other words, you know, they had a mission effort outside of the United States. They also recognized the need to do a missionary effort in the United States. There were 14 denominations, and they formed a committee on Indian affairs. And they had leaders from the YMCA, the YWCA, the American Bible Society, and the Indian Rights Association. And they wanted to sort of agree about doing evangelism amongst Native Americans. And that actually became the National Council of Churches, that parent organization. And the Home Missions Council became the division of home missions within the National Council of Churches. And special focus on Indian affairs has kind of dwindled. It's not there anymore. There has been a lot of missionary work. In 1921, 26 Protestant denominations had Indian missions, and they reported over 32,000 communicants with more than 80,000 constituents. So you need to know that modern Indian religion is often Christian, Protestant, in fact. 161 reservations in 1921 had 428 pastors and evangelists, and they serviced 597 churches and mission stations. That's the Protestant work. On the other side, the Catholics had 705 people working at 149 missions. Catholics were maintaining 336 churches, chapels, and schools, and the priests and religious orders combined their efforts to reach a total of 61,456 Native American Catholics. This is 1921. There were still, in 1921, 40 reservations where they had no resident missionary of any sort to represent Christianity. By 1950, another 10 Protestant denominations had gotten into the missionary work. And they had 833 workers at 437 different mission stations. As you listen to this, you might kind of get a vision, zero in, of the kind of experience, the number of Indian people who experienced missionary work. I think it has something to say about Indian participation in church life today. Lots of Indian people experience Protestant and Catholic religion at the hands of missionaries. And sometimes that had an effect of turning them out the door.
Indians?
Never to return, yeah.
Would those missionaries have always been white? They're almost always?
Yeah. There are a few Native people that went through and became ordained. In fact, actually, between the 30s and the 50s, there were more ordained Native people who were ordained and sent back to the reservation than ever have been done in the more recent years. They did a study in 1974 of all the Protestant denominations and all the Indian groups. There were something like 4 people in seminary with over 400 congregations without pastors. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of an interesting study. They used to have a lot more Native people going for ordination than by, like I said, by 1974, it almost totally disappeared. There's been a major effort since 1974 that has had some real positive results.
Were the missions mostly sort of a straight mission type emphasis, or were there schools or clinics or anything else? Or
well, a whole range, a whole diversity. Maybe as I go through this, you'll get some sense of you know, their missionary stand or their objective.
With the generation of pastors, ordained people coming out of the Indian culture, what happened to turn it off?
To what?
Change,
turn it off?
Change the direction of that. To
I don't know that I can just say, you know, this is what happened, but there are some things that went on that were interesting. In some cases, there was a tremendous reluctance to ordain, but after ordination, to let go of the ministry, so that an ordained Native pastor would be assigned as an assistant to a white pastor. And even though they worked for years and did everything, they never really made it into the system. We have some experiences like that in the Lutheran cycle, where you can't get, since in order to be ordained you have to get a call, in order to get a call you have some processes that go on that are not necessarily in the control of the Native group. Some people wait so long for ordination, and having been ordained, wait so long to actually function that they get really disillusioned. That was an experience of a lot of people, still is. The resurgence of identity and pride, I think, and the realization of how destructive the experience of missionary work had been in the lives of Indian communities made it a lot less attractive to go and be ordained minister in a Protestant denomination or a Catholic denomination.
Does that mean that the missionaries tried to impose their own culture on the Indians instead of being sensitive to the Indian culture?
In many cases, that's what it means. Okay. In 1974, there is a place in Arizona. Do you work at Cook? Do you work with the people at Cook?
Some, yeah. Cook School.
Cook School.
Training School.
In 1974, the United Presbyterian, Protestant, Episcopal, United Methodist, American Baptist, United Church of Christ, Reform, and Christian Reform participants listed 592 Indian parishes with staff numbering 177 missions. And that's 1974. Okay. The tactics have been basically, or in many cases, assimilationist, which is what we were talking about. Um, 22% of the Protestants in 1958 who responded to a questionnaire on whether or not they use Native leadership, and this was a way of measuring how much of an attitude toward assimilation or just an attitude toward the native peoples. Half of the Catholic missionaries use some native leadership. Only 14% of the Protestants use the native language. Only 6% of the Catholics reported that they did. So you see, right, there's a real good kind of indicator of their approach. On the Dakota and Navajo reservations, where the use of native languages is still vigorous, the Protestants who use no Indian language at all was still at 48%, even though most of the people on the reservation spoke in the native language, and the Catholics at 40%. And then when asked whether they had sympathy or a sort of support for Indian customs, no more than 9% of all the Protestant missionaries favored preserving Native American values and lifestyles. And 11% of the Catholics indicated a similar openness. So it's kind of...
What was that?
Only 11% of the Catholics.
That?
That's 1958. So that's the kind of attitude of the missionary. This particular section in here is really filled with those kinds of interesting perspectives on the attitudes of the missionaries to the native indigenous culture and language, the rituals. Like in the 20s, the rituals had been condemned. The sun dance and other religious ceremonies were considered dangerous to health, promoting idleness and superstition. They were